it's a proper place, I think, to talk about God and Calico Cats. Explain the title just a little bit. We have a calico cat, a delightful animal, beautiful cat, whom our daughter misnamed Gucci. It doesn't belong. This cat is one with whom the members of the family have established, I think, a quite close relationship over a relatively short period of time. And before that, we had a poodle for 13 years, the relationship there was equally good, so I'm not discriminatory here. I include both dogs and cats and what I'm about, but got to thinking one day as I was looking at some texts is that if we as human beings are able to establish this kind of relationship with an animal, and where the animal in turn can be so responsive and learn to be so responsive to the human beings in their lives, what kind of relationship must God have with them? That's one of the things that's involved in kind of spinning some of this material this morning and getting you into some texts that have been ignored. The Old Testament is full of texts dealing with animals particularly, but also plants and God's relationship to them. We're living in an era when we have increasing sensitivities to ecological matters, and the church is beginning to get on board with regard to some of these concerns in a way it should have been much earlier. We're just beginning to see some of the resources in the scriptures and elsewhere for our speaking to such matters. Oftentimes, when we talk about ecology, our primary entry point as Christians or as a church is in terms of stewardship. And I would like to suggest that that cannot be the fundamental basis upon which the church relates to ecological matters or encourages sensitivity to such matters amongst its members and in the society of which it's a part more generally. That the fundamental basis for all ecological considerations must be God's relationship, God's specific relationship to the non-human. What is God's relationship to the animals? What is God's relationship to the plants and to other elements of the natural order? And it's that relationship, then, that must constitute the foundations for the building up of matters related to stewardship and other concerns ecological. If you go back into biblical studies the centuries that we've been working at these materials, it's amazing how these passages dealing with these matters have been ignored. There's been a tendency to be quite preoccupied with the human. The human is the center of the universe, an anthropocentrism. And you talk about salvation history, and it's the saving of human beings. Or you talk about existentialist movement, where everything is seen from the perspective of human existence. And even now in some political theologies that are out and about, I worry a little bit about the concentration upon the salvation or the liberation of the human. And nature and animals, the natural order, often then has simply an instrumental value. Of what use is this or that in the natural order for human life? And issues of intrinsic value have not surfaced as much as they ought, though Genesis makes it very clear, does it not, that when God created the animals and when God created the plants and when God created the planets, that after each such creation, God valued it as being very good in and of itself, quite apart from its utilitarian value for human life. But I think the church, perhaps church's perspective on this, can be summed up in a sentence from Emil Brunner, who was a famous theologian, European theologian from the last generation. And it's hard to believe that a theologian could make a comment like this, but I think it has pervaded the life of the church for years. Quote, "The cosmic element in the Bible is never anything more than the scenery in which the history of mankind takes place." And that says it well for what the church has been about and theology has been about for years. So we want to be a little bit more inclusive, should we say, in the way in which we think about these matters these days. And let me begin with some conversations about the relationship between God and the world more generally. This is a fundamental question. How is God related to the world? I think most of us, if we were to go around the room, we'd have a sort of a double world image. We got God's world up here. We got our world down here. And God has his own orbit. We have ours. It's sort of like the hymn. I hate to spoil this hymn for you if you like it. He's got the whole world in his hands. Okay, now what image comes to mind for you when you sing that hymn? Well, I'm reminded of Le Sueur, Minnesota and the Green Giant Company. Okay. God has got, you know, sort of like the Green Giant, and he's holding this world in his hand. And a corollary of that, of course, is that God is in absolute control of everything. And if you get a Green Giant with a little pea in his fingers, you'll never know what that Green Giant might have in mind for them to squish it or throw it or, you know. It reminds me, you know, another image that comes to mind is like a 12-year-old with a baseball. You know, what's going to happen to the world in the hands of that boy or that giant? The problem with this double world image is, how are you going to get God and the world together? How are you going to get God involved in the world? Well, usually what happens is that you get an interventionist God. That God now and again intervenes, you know, poof, there, God is very active, and then he sort of goes back up into the clouds again, and we go on our way, and boom, and God comes once again to do one thing or another. I think a lot of the movies these days are predicated on that sort of image of God. E.T., who's E.T.? It's the one from another world, comes here, loving, especially for the kids, right? And you got the Star Wars series, clearly predicated on a kind of double world image for the relationship between God and our world. And all of this understanding, of course, between the relationship between God and our world is such that it's designed to give you sort of a permanent crick in your neck. Because you're always looking for when God might pop in, you know, to do this or that, but you're never sure where it might occur. And then you're always left wondering why it is that God chose to act over there, but he didn't choose to act in my life when I needed it most. And you end up with a God who acts arbitrarily in life. Well, another image that we have is we have a double world image still, but then we connect them. We have a little connecting point, and it's called Jesus. There, through Jesus, God enters into the life of the world. But we get that understanding such that it's only through Jesus that one can connect God and world. And everything that God does in the world somehow has to be filtered through Jesus. But those of us who work in the Old Testament have a little bit of a problem with that, because God was active and involved in the world long before Jesus came. And we need to talk in more inclusive terms, I think, about the way in which God, and not simply Jesus, is active and present in the life of the world. So I would like to move to a third image instead of a double world image at all. You work to a single world image. God's world and our world are the same. And as the hymn puts it, this is my Father's world, not some other world. God's at home in this world. Now, God is other than this world. God is not a human being. God's not the natural order. God's not any element in the world. God is other than this world, but God is in this world. God has chosen to make the world this world his home. And so the one passage that I'd like to lift up as a key word for our understanding here is Jeremiah 23:25, as one to hang on to for some understanding at this point. We can begin with verse 23. Am I a God at hand, says the Lord, and not a God afar off? Can a human being hide himself in secret places so that I cannot see him, says the Lord? Do not I fill heaven and earth? But what if we worked with that image? God fills heaven and earth. The world is full of God. That in every nook and cranny of the universe, there's God. So that God's place is in this world. God's home is in this world. Wherever there is world, there's God. And one of the images that we sometimes work with too, as we relate, sometimes relate God and world like a mechanic is to a car. You get an external relationship of God to the world. And every now and again something on that engine or something on the car needs fixing, and the problem is how to get the mechanic to get it fixed. And you know as well, in working with local garages and so forth, all the maneuvers and all the conversation that needs to take place to get something properly fixed. Well, that's sort of like prayer life, etc. And people get to thinking about God as kind of a mechanic in relationship to the world, and God as a fixer. Well, in this image, you've got God working from within rather than working on the world from without. Now, let me give you a couple of other passages, sort of one macrocosmic and one microcosmic to try to fill this out. Turn to Psalm 33 and then 36. Could keep them side by side here. So you've got God filling the world, being full of God. And how do we talk about this in a little more complete sense? Psalm 33, verse 5. God loves righteousness and justice, and the earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord. There's that language of fullness again. Where there is God, who fills the heavens and the earth, there also is love. Look at 36, Psalm 36, beginning with verse 5 and going on to verse 6. Thy steadfast love, O Lord, extends to the heavens, thy faithfulness to the clouds. Thy righteousness is like the mountains of God. The judgments are like the great deeps. And then this wonderful line, human beings and animals you save. You save, O Lord. But notice the steadfast love of the Lord fills the world as God fills the world. So that wherever God is active in the life of the world, and that's everywhere, this God is present in love. So that whatever God is about it in a loving way. His love pervades all. And that's filled out in some detail in Psalm 136. Psalm 136, which is a litany, where every other line is, for his steadfast love endures forever, Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. And then you go through and you see all the things with which God's love is connected. Verse 5, he made the heavens, his steadfast love. He spread out the earth, his steadfast love. He made the great lights, his steadfast love. The sun, the moon, the stars, his steadfast love. All the way down to verse 25, and he gives food to all flesh, to all people and animals together, for his steadfast love endures. So this God who fills the heaven and earth fills it with love in every conceivable activity. If that's sort of macrocosmic, Now let's move down to something that's microcosmic and turn to Psalm 139. We'll deal with more with Psalm 139 tomorrow morning, but we need to take a brief look here at the psalm beginning with verse 13. For thou didst form my inward parts, thou didst knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise thee, for thou art fearful and wonderful. Wonderful are thy works. Thou knowest me right well. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was being made in secret, that is to say, in the womb, intricately wrought in the depths of the earth, that is to say, in the depths of the earth, and is a metaphor for the womb of the mother. There your God's eyes beheld my unformed substance. God here is feminine image. God is a seamstress who knits us all together in our mother's wombs. We have a real problem at times in God's relationship to the world, God's relationship to us all, by connecting God only with the spiritual, connecting God with the interpersonal life, and restricting God to that sort of presence and activity. But here God is at work in the body. God is at work in the most microscopic surgical way, knitting together a body in a mother's womb. Now, we have great difficulty talking about God's activity. I mean, doesn't medical research and medical understandings manage to take care of all of these kinds of things? I mean, that explains birthing, gestation and birthing, but here God is involved in all of the intricacies of the gestation process. You know, it may well be that apart from faith you can give an intelligible account of what goes on here for a variety of purposes such as medical research, but the biblical faith will claim that no full account of any event is possible without factoring God somehow into the process. And we don't talk like this anymore. Our God is kind of for the nooks and, you know, a few gaps in life and special occasions and what have you. But I'm sure you all have seen Chariots of Fire, right? About the two runners preparing for the 1924 Olympics, and one of them a Jew and the other a Christian Scotsman, Eric Little, who became a missionary to China. And I'll never forget the moment in the theater when we watched that movie. Brought laughter in the audience where we were when Eric Little made that comment, you know, God made me for a purpose. God made me fast. We don't talk that way anymore. We tend to keep God confined to the spiritual and to the psychical and those that kind of interpersonal stuff. But here God's at work in the body. Amidst all those blood vessels and brain waves and bronchial tubes, huh? Making life possible there. And you know, sure, the effects of sin get things all botched up at times. If the mother takes drugs during pregnancy, yeah, something's going to happen. But God's presence is not all determining. God's not in control of that situation. So what human beings do can mess things up. But we need to get our God involved in all of these intricacies of life in a way that we haven't. Which brings us to the animals, but there's a question right here.
I was going to say, my four-year-old figured it out because she wanted to ask me the other night, she says, well, if God's in our heart, is that the same heart that pumps our blood?
Uh-huh.
Neat. I mean, I really think sometimes we listen
That's
to our
neat.
Kids, they'll tell us.
That's very nice. When we talk about God being in our heart, we tend to understand heart in purely psychical terms. And that's a nice move. God's in our heart in both understandings of heart.
I decided just to tell you yes.
Yeah, good. It reminds me of the children's question, and a number of adults ask this question too. When my dog or cat dies, will it go to heaven?
My dad was smart. When he told us kids, when that we asked the question, he says, if it's important for you, it'll be there.
Yeah. Well, not if, even, I think it won't. Not even more than that. Not only if it's important for you, the question will be, if it's important for God. And the biblical materials answer that question right on, you know. And you can just point people to Isaiah 11. And Isaiah 11 will tell you the answer to that question. And we can begin here to move into many, many passages in the Old Testament to talk about God's relationship to the animals. In this picture of the new heaven and the new earth, it occurs twice in Isaiah, both here in chapter 11 and in 65. Beginning with verse 6, you know this passage. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid and the calf, and the lion and the fatling together. And a little child shall lead them, and the cow and the bear shall feed, and their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. And they shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that new heaven and new earth, playing with the children will be all the animals. I mean, that's the vision for the new world. Martin, it's kind of interesting, one of the Lutheran forebears, Martin Luther, has a number of interesting things that I want to bring tomorrow, but there's a neat quote here. Those of us who've been on the paths of Holden paths will appreciate this quote from dear Martin about the animals. The mouse is, this comes from his commentary on Genesis, the mouse is a divine creature. For its kind, it has a very beautiful form, such pretty feet, and such delicate hair, that it is clear that it was created by the Word of God with a definite plan in view. Therefore, we should admire God's creation and workmanship. And then Luther concludes with a characteristic flourish. The same could also be said about flies. Hey, your 7-year-old's right in tune with some of this stuff.
She or he
has been reading Albert Schweitzer.
She just has a lot of God's love in her heart. She's very tender-hearted with all living beings.
Excuse me. How to respond to that comment so as to encourage the development of that kind of reflection and not put it down and not discourage that direction in one's thinking. I think one of the things that lie at the basis of a number of these texts in the Old Testament is an understanding of God's relationship to the animal world such that there's a certain interiority or certain inwardness in the animals to which God relates. And I think it goes beyond the animals, even into the plant world, as we'll see from a couple of texts. And that God has established a relationship with the non-human world such that it's not simply God being present to these non-human creatures or with them, but within them. And let's just flip around some texts, okay? And see what happens. Let's turn to Psalm 50. 50:50. This beginning with verse 10. Verse 9 is wonderful. That was the motto for a senior class at Luther Seminary not too long ago. I'll accept no bull from your house. But but verse 10 and 11. For every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on 1,000 hills, and I know all the birds of the air, and all that moves in the field is mine. Isn't that wonderful? It reminds you a little bit of that, the passage of Jesus, that no sparrow falls without God's knowing of it. It goes, it's wonderful lines in this psalm. The next one is, if I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you. That's the next one, who God says. But if then you get this to the natural world then, and all of its particulars as understood to have a special relationship with God, a passage like that. And God, God's relationship to the earth and to the non-human has a certain conversational character to it. And so there are some passages that speak this way. Even, you can even look up at verse 4 of Psalm 50. And you see, God calls to the heavens above. God calls to the earth. There's that. There's a calling out to that which is non-human. Yesterday, remember, we looked in Genesis 1 at verse 22, where God's first speaking in the newly created world was to the animals, be fruitful and multiply. So, turn to Psalm 145. Verse 10. Sometimes there are the words that are used that hide some of this. But look at verse 10. All of thy works shall give thanks to thee, O Lord. What does it mean to speak of all of thy works? Well, all of God's creative activity is involved in expressing thankfulness. Now, on Friday, we're going to talk about non-human sopranos and altos, and we'll see some more, some greater dimensions of this. But then go on to verse 15. The eyes of all, this is a familiar passage to many of us, the eyes of all look to thee, and thou givest them their food in due season. Thou openest thy hand and satisfiest the desire of every living thing. But notice that beginning of the verse 15, the eyes of all look to thee. Then just over to Psalm 147. Verse 4, God determines the number of the stars, and God gives to all of them their names. There are a couple of passages in the Old Testament which talk about God naming every element in the universe, that God has names for them. What does it mean for something to have a name? You've got to have a relationship of some kind for them to talk in this language. Look at verse 9 of Psalm 147. God gives to the beasts their food. He gives to the young ravens, which cry out to God for their food. God gives them their food. Turn to there's a remarkable passage in the immediately preceding book, Job. And we're going to get into Job more tomorrow, but just take a look at chapter 12 here for a moment. The book of Job. Beginning with verse 7.
Which chapter is that?
Chapter 12, Job. Ask the beasts, and they'll teach you. Ask the birds of the air, and they'll tell you. Or the plants of the earth, and they'll teach you. And the fish of the sea, they'll declare it to you. And who among all these doesn't know that the hand of the Lord has done this? There you have a remarkable passage with regard to the knowledge of God's ways in the world on the part of various aspects of the non-human creation. Now, we'll talk more about this, but probably we'll sometimes kind of dismiss passages like that as hyperbole or something. But there's much, given the range of materials that we have to do, with which we have to do here, it's more than that. Then, given the drought situation this summer all over the country, which many of us have experienced, I think we need to take a look at a passage in Joel. It's Hosea, Joel, Amos, the second of the minor prophets. Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel. Joel is a text that really ought to have been, I hope it was used in a number of parishes this summer. Because it occasions all kinds of reflections in a time of drought. Chapter 1 of the book of Joel, beginning with verse 17. The seed shrivels under the clods, and the storehouses are desolate, and the granaries are ruined because the grain has failed. And how the beasts groan, and the herds of the cattle are perplexed. What does it mean to talk about cattle being perplexed? Because there is no pasture for them, and even the flocks of sheep are dismayed. Unto thee, O Lord, I cry, for fire, drought, has devoured the pastures of the wilderness, and flame has burned all the trees of the field. And even the wild beasts cry to thee, because water brooks are dried up, and fire has destroyed the pastures of the wilderness. Now notice that in the talking about the drought and the effects of the drought, not simply interested here in the reaction of the humans and the effect upon the human community. Notice the interest in the response of the animal world to what has happened. The relationship to God, that is to say, the beasts cry to God in the midst of this devastation. You're all familiar, of course, with the flood story and the beginning of the Bible, and we often don't remember it at all in its fullness. Only 8 human beings were saved, but certainly many more animals than that were saved. The word to Noah and his family at the time of the flood was save the animals. That's the basic word that comes through there. Save the animals. And Noah does. And then notice what God does at the end of the flood, chapter 9 of Genesis. Verse 8. And God said to Noah and to his sons with him, Behold, I establish my covenant, or I make a promise with you and your descendants after you. And with every living creature that's with you, the birds and the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark, I make a promise to you all, the people and to the animals, that I will never again visit the earth in flood-like ways. God making promises, not simply to human beings, but to the animal world too. And so this theme then of here God saves the animal world along with the human world. We've seen in a psalm like Psalm 36 where salvation language is used not simply for human beings but also for the animals. And then we've seen that wonderful picture of the new heaven and the new earth where animals will play with children. And that would be characteristic of that new day. Now, of course, human beings have a crucial role to play in all of this. In the 8th chapter of Romans, Paul speaks in language that you're very familiar with, but maybe we could refresh our memory of Romans chapter 8. Beginning with verse 18. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. All of creation, including the animal world, is related to humans in very important ways. What human beings do affects the shape of the world around them in ways that's not characteristic of other creatures of God. Back in the flood story, Noah's righteousness did have an effect upon the animals when in the ark. And here too, what human beings do, the shape that their lives take, will make a difference as far as the rest of the non-human world is concerned, or the non-human world is concerned. and which lifts up, of course, our responsibility to that which is not human. But I think that we ought, more often than we do, ground the sense of responsibility for that which is non-human, not simply in a sense of stewardship for what we've been given, but in a sense, a much deeper sense, that God has a special relationship with all of that which is non-human. That we need to think of some sense of inwardness, some interiority in that which is non-human, to which God relates, so that we can talk about a relationship of consequence between God and the non-human world. To come back to my calico cat, if in fact I can talk about my relationship to my cat, or you can talk about your relationship to your dog or whatever, in ways that are really remarkable in terms of range, in terms of your responsiveness to each other, what must be possible for God? We are in so many ways alienated from the animal world. God is not alienated from that world. So what must the closeness of that relationship actually be? And if God has that kind of relationship with all of the animals and all of non-human creation around us, then that behooves us to be careful, concerned, because of how dear all of this is to God. To God. Well, let's talk about it a little bit. Yeah.
Do you think God would really want us to be all vegetarians? Because after you reading this now, I feel like I would like meat. I honestly do. I mean, I'm not.
It's kind of, it. You know, it's if you go back to Genesis 1, let's go back to the beginning. Look at verse 29 of chapter 1 of Genesis. And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food." Then if you go to chapter 9, Genesis. Yeah. Right. Let's read 30. Notice that he continues in the same vein. To every beast, God is concerned about the important point. God's concerned about feeding the beast too. To every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps upon the earth, everything that has breath of life, I've been given every green plant for food. So it's not just simply human beings that God has given plants for food, but to the animals too. I mean, notice the care to lift up, you know, to give attention to the non-humans in this context. Then if you go to chapter 9, and chapter 9 now is on the far side of the sin of Adam and Eve. And notice what happens in verse 2 of chapter 9. The fear of you and the dread of you is upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the air, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. And into your hand they are delivered, and every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Now, something happens between Genesis 1 and Genesis 9. And, I don't know which of these chapters you want to push with regard to vegetarianism or non-vegetarianism. Well, given the fact that we're in the situation of chapter 9, let's go with that one. Or do you lift up chapter 1 as something toward which all human beings ought to strive? And it's a question I think that can't be resolved. I think that it's very important for there to be vegetarians because of what they remind us of. It's very, very significant point that they lift up for our attention. The fact that they're always around us with those kinds of concerns makes that point very well. You know, Israel, you could get into some interesting discussions with regard to the food laws in the book of Leviticus. You notice, you know, the case has been made that there are certain animals that were to be used for food and certain animals that were not to be used for food, and that's also related to this issue of, it's not simply a health issue that pork was prohibited, but it has to do with certain animals, animal families and so forth, being off limits for some of these reasons, namely the relationship between God and that world. Those are just some reflections.
Thank you. Okay. That answers another question in my mind, though. How do you resolve all the animal sacrificing that God wanted in the Old Testament? I mean, if he had such a relationship with all living beings, all created, why would he ask us to offer all these animal sacrifices?
Let alone Jesus.
Well, yeah, okay.
There's a human sacrifice there. Yeah.
Right.
It's kind of interesting it's a very helpful question, and one which we could push in a number of ways. One of the things about the sacrificial text in the book of the first chapters of Leviticus in particular is that they tend to talk about the procedures relative to sacrifice, and they don't give the rationale for this or that very fully. And so scholars really have a tough time trying to sort that all out in terms of what the significance is. But one of the key passages in the book of Leviticus has to do with the fact that you can't eat the blood. You all know that, okay? The kosher move. And why is that? The reason for it is that the ancient Hebrews believed that the blood was life, and all life belonged to God. Okay? And so the blood, then, the reason we don't eat blood is that's the life that's to be returned to God. And so that there's a real concern for God's relationship to the animal in the sacrificial system relative to the non-eating of that life element in each of the animals. So, I mean, one could talk about that a little bit more. So there is some concern for that issue, I think, there. But it doesn't explain it fully, I think.
Which brings up just a quick sub-question. Cain and Abel's sacrifices. Here he had Abel. Wasn't he offering a lamb, I believe it was? That was even before they were told that they could eat of the meat. So why again, so early in that period, they had that purposeful killing of a sacrifice?
Yeah.
Was that something that the other people did?
I'm not certain what you mean by the other.
Okay,
Cain
and Abel.
Cain
and Abel.
Right. It's the Cain and Abel story is a troublesome story in many ways. Why does God prefer Abel's offering to Cain's offering?
Yeah.
So we're not told, and so you'll struggle with. With the divine preference in that instance. Some people suggest that this passage reflects some ancient antipathies between the row farmer, the farmers who raised grain and the farmers who raised cattle. You know, those kinds of things. God prefers those who raised cattle, but it's a very difficult text. Overall, it's just concerned about the spread of humankind, the spread of sinfulness among humankind, I think. Yes?
I worry about house pets in this order, you know, this order of creation and relationship, and it just seems like a perverted relationship when I go down the grocery store aisle of pet foods, you know, and I just wonder if God intended for us to have house pets.
I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe somebody else has some wisdom here. My sense of things is that in terms of experience, some experience with animals in the home, is that one, it sensitizes us to our relationship to the non-human world. I say we develop, in that context, we develop relationships with the non-human that are significant, that are long-lasting. We learn from, and we learn from that, I mean, the forgiving character of that poodle over 13 years. I mean, absolutely. I learned more about forgiveness from that poodle than from almost anything else. And the care and the concern for the animal world that develops within the home as a consequence of this. I don't know, I think there are many positive things that develop out of those kinds of relationships. I think that the way we spend money sometimes on various aspects of our pets' lives could be looked at somewhat more closely. But the reality, I respond positively to. I don't know. Help me a little bit more on your negativity.
Well, yeah, and I could add to that too, being as a nurse and knowing, you know, people that have actually responded to animals, you know, someone grieving recently with the loss of a wife or whatever, dogs and monkeys with people who are handicapped, they can form such close bondings to animals. Yeah. That maybe they wouldn't be able to quite so easily or quite so readily. There's no one, no other human there that they can bond with. And it's a real blessing. It's a very positive aspect.
Isn't it so that it's been shown now that if some of these older people have animals with them, that they're more alert and they're... So that their own humanity is elevated in a way by the presence of animals, and it would not be the case otherwise. So.
Yeah, I know. When I'm mad at my husband and the kids, I go and pet my cat.
Good for you.
Well, and that brings up another thing. Animals seem to sense when you are sad or lonely, or you know, that's when they come closest to you.
Right.
They have that inner sense.
You know, the scriptures have a variety of passages where they talk about human beings learning from animals. You know, the passage in Proverbs about learning from the ants, for example. I don't know. Do you know that passage in Proverbs 6? That wonderful. Ants are different from dogs. I mean, if this is possible for. For ants, what must be possible to speak about for dogs and so forth. But chapter 6 of Proverbs, beginning with verse, go to the ant, O sluggard, and consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer, or ruler, she prepares her food in summer and gathers her sustenance in harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little sound slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a vagabond and want like an armed man. I mean, very interesting material, but you know, learn from the ant. And Israel, if you like the passage like Isaiah 1 on a couple of books, right off the bat, in Isaiah's prophetic words against Israel, notice verse 2 of chapter 1 of Isaiah, or start with the end of verse 2. Sons have I reared and brought up, but they rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, and the ass its master's crib. Yeah, but my Israel does not know, my people does not understand. I mean, the animals, the owner here and the master are not simply a human being. That's God, I think. And here you have behavior then on the part of animals, which is exemplary compared to what the behavior of human beings is. Jeremiah has a couple of interesting passages about the birds in this regard too. So the animals are lifted up as those from which we learn, and which can teach us a great deal in a variety of contexts, whether it be situations of distress, etc. Sammy.
Well, Well, I think it isn't only humans that destroy animals, you know, food, but the animal world itself are predators upon one another. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's always in tension in a world which is not whole, which is always broken. And, you know, when you talk about the lamb lying with the wolf or whatever, that's talking about wholeness without brokenness. And I think that that's always that to which God calls us. And we always live in that tension, in this kind of broken world. I wanted to say something else. David Power has been doing a lot on this whole imaging of God with world. And last night we had a really drag out session on the world as God's body. Mm-hmm. And everything you said today points to that. God fills it. The world fills God and vice versa. And it almost made that imagery much more clear for me. It really struggled with that, but it's a good image.
I think it's a tough one to work with. I was there for the first session with David, and I've read McFaig's material. This is if you don't know the book, it's you haven't heard David's presentation. It's Sally McFaig has a book entitled "Models of God: Theology for an Ecological Nuclear Age." I think that's it. And where she talks about the world as God's body, but I think you're right. I think that many of these Old Testament passages do find a way of connecting in helpful ways with that. I think, generally speaking, that we as a church have worked with an understanding of divine transcendence, worked with an understanding of God as having another world, as being off in the distance and now and again popping in. And somehow we've got to get back into this biblical mode of God present and active in the nook and cranny, every nook and cranny of our lives. Yes?
Well, I don't know that it's original with him, but Matthew Fox, who wrote Original Blessing, talks about panentheism.
Sure.
As opposed to pantheism. Panentheism being the idea that God is in everything, as opposed to saying that, as opposed to pantheism, which says that, you know, God, this rock is God,
right,
or that cow is God. But the idea of God being in everything really makes sense to me more and more.
You put a name on what I've been talking about. I think the word panentheism is a little bit problematic in some circles, and so I don't like to use that word, and it's such an awkward word, but that's it. God in, with, and under everything there is in the world. And we, you know, those of us who are Lutherans, and those from other communions as well, but certainly those we who are Lutherans have had this pounded into our heads in connection with our understanding of the Lord's Supper being God in, with, and under the elements of the sacrament. I mean, that's that kind of understanding of God's relationship to the world as a whole, so that our understanding of the sacrament is a special instance of God's relationship to the whole world.
I could just say one other thing. I just thought about the fact that as we move God out of the world, we as Christians also move out of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as God, who has called us and who has blessed us and privileged us as that called and chosen people. I often use a description of the world in one room and Christians in another room, and that we target that other world and try to bring it into our world, rather than seeing again ourselves within that God-created world as an infection of life.
That's helpful. It's very important. We talk about the fact that we're to follow God. You know, and if God's like this, then we must be like that. And so, again, to come back to that, our images of God issue, the way you image God is the way in which your life will be shaped, willy-nilly. Yeah.
I heard a story about a flood in Missouri or something, and the guy got up to the second floor, and the flood water kept coming up, and a boat came by and said, "Hop in, we'll save you." And he said, "No, God's going to save me." He went up the roof, the flood water kept getting higher, a second boat came by, and he said, they said, "Hop in, you know." He said, "No, God's going to save me." And it kept getting higher and higher, and he got up the chimney, and a third boat came by and said, "Hop in, we'll save you. This is the last boat to come by." And he said, "No, God's going to save me." and he drowned. And he was up in heaven, and he said, "Why didn't you save me, God?" And God said, "I sent 3 boats.
I think that in many ways modern technological and medical developments have occasioned that kind of thinking among us. When a member of my family was through wonderful doctors and the use of medicine was healed. How do you talk about that? How do you talk about that? I think that we've gotten to the point where we tend to talk about the doctors and medicine, and that's what healed us. When in fact Christians ought to be saying, God, in and through the use of doctors and medicine, has been involved in our healing. That's the same point, only it just permeates our life.
Right. I work at a Seventh-day Adventist hospital, and I thank God every day that I've got a job in such an environment, because there you are encouraged to always give God the praise. The doctors pray before surgery and ask the Lord to come and be the great physician and healer. Give them wisdom with surgeries and, use their hands wisely. And the nurses, and it's just an all-pervading thing. And the patients really are in such a calm and such a relaxed state because they feel at peace, like the Lord is in control here. And even saying prayers with them in the evenings, praying for their for a restful evening and waking in the morning feeling restored and renewed so they can go home and fix their life again. It's just a beauty that you just can't find anywhere.
That's a very interesting testimony. I wasn't aware of that. We could well follow that. One of the problems that one could run into, and it was suggested by one little phrase in your comment, is you could run into a situation there where you believe that God was in fact in control of the situation. And so if you die in surgery, that's God doing that. I'm curious now, do people in that situation, if they believe that God is in control, when in fact they die, is the upshot of, well, obviously they can't respond, but the family's response, the doctor's response, is their response saying, well, this is, God has done this? I mean, how does it work?
When bad things happen to good people.
Well, it just, death isn't the worst thing.
No, that's true. And the older you get, the more you realize that.
Well, and too, I think another thing that's brought up is there are different levels of healing. It's not all physical. Some of it is spiritual and some of it is emotional. And I think that's encouraged there too. It's not all, in fact, because the emphasis is on health, it's not just physical health, even though they encourage to eat, healthy. Yeah.
I think it's really heartening to see the extent to which God is understood to be involved in every aspect of the life of such a health institution. Yeah. I would hope that there's also a recognition that human beings and human activity is also very crucial to what happens at every stage along the way in that setting, and so that if somebody dies under the knife, that God is not the one to blame in that setting, and it may well be that the doctor didn't get quite enough sleep the night before, or whatever. So the whole issue of divine agency and human agency in that setting becomes very, very crucial balance there. Yes?
Having been through several surgeries this summer and being in that position, I felt more God's presence rather than God's control. And so that sheds a different light on it. I mean, whatever happens, that God is present there in that operating room. And his love just surrounds you.
It's a very, very, very helpful, very important distinction to make between God's presence and God's control.
Should we ask then for that kind of control? Should we ask for back intervention? Should we ask them?
No.
What is the function of prayer in that context? What kind of, I mean, what kind of prayers ought one pray in that situation?
Psalm 61, hear my cry, O Lord, attend unto my prayer, from the end of the earth will I pray unto thee.
Okay.
Ask anything you wish.
Okay.
I think thy will be done.
Thy will be done. Is that okay?
If we could just start thinking as death not the end but the new beginning, that would really help, wouldn't it?
It's kind of, you know, one of the, what, perhaps, I don't know if it would help me, one of the things I find very interesting is, you know, the Old Testament people did not believe in an afterlife, except at the very end. I mean, there was, in fact, eternal life waiting for them, but they didn't have that as a part of their understanding of God and God's relationship with the world. And I find that very interesting. I wonder how pastoral counselors functioned in that setting when they weren't able to hold out the hope of eternal life to those with whom they were working. And I'd like to approach text, Old Testament text, particularly the Psalms, with that understanding, and to see what ways of speaking about God are helpful without sort of that the hope of resurrection or eternity being there as sort of the first line of conversation with regard to such matters. Well, maybe let's continue tomorrow. Thank you very much.